Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, brought to you from our offices overlooking San Francisco's financial district. I am Tom Merle, a member of the club's program committee and your chairman today. We also welcome those listeners joining us today on radio for America's longest-running radio program. We invite all our listeners here and on radio to visit the club's website at commonwealthclub.org. And now for today's speaker. Christina Hoff Summers is currently W.H. Brady Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C. She received her bachelor's from NYU and a Ph.D. in philosophy from Brandeis. And from 1980 until last year, she served on the faculty of Clark University in Worcester, Mass., teaching courses in American culture. And I don't know, Christine, they allow you to teach in the Women's Studies program? She has edited two collections of essays, Right and Wrong, Basic Readings and Ethics, and Vice and Virtue for Everyday Life. In 1994, she brought her formidable reasoning skills to a stinging critique of the women's liberation leadership with her book, Who Stole Feminism? How Women Have Betrayed Women. The book is still reverberating among the sisterhood, but it made a major contribution towards focusing the debate on gender roles and conflict. Ms. Summers' hard-hitting articles have appeared in the New Republic, London Times, Wall Street Journal, the Philadelphia Inquirer, and other major metropolitan newspapers. She has assumed the role of a pundit, she's a member of the Commentariat, on a range of topics and speaks on radio and TV, 2020, Oprah, Crossfire, and of course, Politically Incorrect. She resides in Chevy Chase outside of Washington. She has a husband, Fred, and two boys. And I just learned prior to this that she was born in Petaluma and grew up in L.A. She's a California woman. So, Christine, would you address us, please? Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Christina Hoff Summers, a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. For most of my career, I have been a professor of philosophy, writing about ethics and moral philosophy. I have also written extensively about the influence of feminism on American culture. And this afternoon, I'm going to talk to you about some of the themes in my new book, The War Against Boys. I will try to give you the best, most up-to-date information on how boys are faring in our society. I'll speak for about 25, 30 minutes and allow plenty of time for questions. There is a surprising amount of hostility towards boys in this country. To put it bluntly, boys are politically incorrect. We face the possibility that we may be becoming perhaps the first society in history to turn against its male children. And in my new book, I try to show how this is happening, why this is happening, and what can be done to turn things around. I'll begin by telling you a story of something that happened during a television debate I had with the celebrity lawyer Gloria Allred. Ms. Allred was representing a 14-year-old girl who was suing the Boy Scouts of America for excluding girls. Now, girls 15 and older can join Explorer Scouts, which is co-ed, but Ms. Allred was outraged that girls younger than 15 were not allowed in. And she referred to same-sex scouting as gender apartheid. Well, I defended the Boy Scouts, and I told her that younger boys and girls have rather different play preferences and interests. And I illustrated this by a sort of homespun example. I told her a story about a major toy company, Hasbro Toys, decided they wanted to market a kind of playhouse, dollhouse to both boys and girls. And they brought the children into their fun lab in Providence, Rhode Island, and their researchers were observing how the children interacted with the structure. And the girls came in and played constructively with the dolls and dressed them and fed them and played house. The boys came in and catapulted the baby carriage from the roof. So I told Ms. Allred, you know, simply, doesn't it seem like boys and girls are different? And she bristled, and she denied there were any innate differences. She seemed shocked by the boys' catapulting behavior. She took it as a sign, I suppose, of potential violence. And she said, quote, "If there are boys who catapult baby carriages off the roof of dollhouses, that's just one more reason why we should be socializing boys at an earlier age, perhaps to be playing with dolls." Gloria Steinem often says, we need to raise our boys more like our girls. Well, Ms. Allred, Ms. Steinem, they have rather powerful allies. There are many in schools of education who believe that there is something wrong with boys, that they need to be re-engineered, re-socialized, not because these educators and activists want to be mean to boys. It's not because they don't like them or want to harm them. It's because they sincerely believe something is badly wrong with the nation's boys. A growing number of experts now claim that the nation's male children are disturbed, depressed, not in touch with their feelings, and for that reason, prone to violence. According to these critics, it's their maleness, their masculinity that is making them so miserable and dangerous. Two psychologists at Harvard University, Carol Gilligan and William Pollack, have declared a national boy crisis. So there's now a new movement sweeping the nation to save the males. Well, do American boys need to be saved? Do they need to be rescued from their masculinity? I don't think so. I don't agree that the nation's boys are in crisis. I see no evidence for it. Some boys, of course, are in serious trouble. So too are some girls. A small percentage of boys are antisocial, violent. But when you look at genuine social science research, what you find is that the majority of boys are mentally healthy. Being a boy is not a defect. It's not something you need to recover from. I have two quotations. One is from William Pollack, and it's from his new book. He says, there are millions of boys who are on cast out on a sea in separate lifeboats. They feel they're drowning in isolation, depression, loneliness, despair. And he's speaking of mainstream children. And I read a quote by Jean-Jacques Rousseau, the 18th century philosopher, about boys, which describes most of the boys I know and perhaps the boys you know. He says, I look at a healthy boy of 10 or 12 and I see a bright, eager, vigorous a child completely absorbed in the present, rejoicing in abounding vitality. And as I said, it just seems to me that to speak of boys as in some kind of trend towards crisis is not grounded in reality. I think Rousseau in the 18th century had a more insight. Now, I am not saying that there are no problems with boys. Many boys today are intellectually and morally underdeveloped, and I'll say more about that later. And I will say, as a society, we could do a much better job teaching boys and girls about right and wrong. But anyway, what I want to do for the next few minutes is to tell you about this strange new movement to liberate boys from their maleness. And the best way to explain the Save the Males movement is by way of examples. I'll tell you about some of the programs and initiatives that have been planned for boys. Some of what I'm about to describe may sound strange or extreme. It is. What worries me is that if nobody stands up to protest this, it could easily become mainstream. Example one. You've all probably heard of Take Your Daughters to Work Day, a very popular holiday designed by the Ms. Foundation for girls. It's a sort of career day, self-esteem day for girls. There's been a lot of pressure on the Ms. Foundation to include boys, and many businesses, in fact, have changed it to Take Your Child to Work Day. And the Ms. Foundation is very distressed at this development, and for the past few years, they've been trying to find a way to combat this. They want to maintain the feminist purity of the holiday. So, a few years ago, Marie Wilson, the president of the Ms. Foundation, and some of her allies in girl advocacy movement came up with an idea called Sons Day. This would be a special holiday for boys, and maybe if there was a holiday for boys, the pressure would be off to include boys in Daughters Day. Well, here are some of the ways they suggested Sons Day be celebrated. They had a list of festivities for the children. Number one, take your son to an event that focuses on ending men's violence against women. Call the Family Violence Prevention Fund, 1-800-END-ABUSE, for information. Number two, plan a game or sport or contest specifically that does not keep score and does not declare a winner. Number three, Since Sunday is on a Sunday, make sure your son is involved in preparing the family for work and the school week ahead. This means laying out clothes for siblings and making lunches. Well, for boys not totally exhausted by all of the excitement of the day's activities, they had some evening suggestions. Take your son grocery shopping and help him plan and prepare the family meal. Well, as the Ms. Experts planned this day, the Ms. Foundation staff planned this day, Son's Day would not even give the boys a day off from school, so they wouldn't be happy about that. One friend of mine called it a holiday in hell for Junior. In the end, this little holiday was scrapped, and they've gone back to the drawing board. But just think about it for a moment. This is a mainstream organization, the Ms. Foundation, and yet the activities that came to their mind for our boys is, you know, dialing 1-800-END-ABUSE for holiday tips. They regard boys as too competitive, too undomesticated, prone to violence, in serious need of re-education. Second example. Quit It. This is a teacher's guide. It's an anti-harassment guide for children, grades K through 3. Quit It is a teacher's manual to help organize classroom activities. It's especially designed to calm boys down. It was written in part by the Wellesley Center for Research on Women, but it was funded by the U.S. Department of Education through the Safe and Drug-Free Schools Act, so your taxpayer dollars paid for this. The authors explain in the preface why boys need special training. They say it's not that boys are bad, it's just that we could do a much better job addressing the aggressive behavior of young boys. And Quit It, this manual, introduces teachers to activities designed to calm boys down. Now, one of the suggested activities, which will give you a sense of the general philosophy of this guide, which is, by the way, a bestseller. It's disseminated, it's distributed by the National Education Association, the largest teachers union. On their website, they say it's a bestseller among teachers. Here's a typical activity. The game of tag, you know, playing chase in the playground. What this guidebook does is introduce a less threatening version of the game. The guide says the teacher is supposed to say, before going out to play tag, talk to the students about how they feel playing tag. Do they like to be chased? Do they like to do the chasing? How does it feel to be tagged out? Get their ideas about other ways the game might be played. Well, after the students share their fears and apprehensions about tag, the teacher is advised to announce that there will be a new non-threatening version of the game called Circle of Friends, where no one is ever out. Now, it's good preparation for life. No one is ever out. But anyway, perhaps some of the students experience anger during this Circle of Friends. Well, the guide provides the teachers with tools for organizing in-class anger management workshops. In reading through Quit It, you have to remind yourself that these suggestions are intended for, not for disturbed children, but for normal 5- and 6-year-olds in our nation's schools. Now, I will report that not all little boys are going along with these efforts to re-socialize them. Just to take an example, a local example, there's a very, very feminist teacher in the San Francisco public schools named Miss Judy Logan. She's actually quite an inspired teacher, but she is so radically feminist that I think if you read about it, it sometimes seems to drive the boys and the girls a little crazy. One activity that she had was that all the children would make a quilt. All of her sixth graders would make a quilt. Each one would stitch a little muslin square celebrating women we admire. Well, it turns out boys don't create quite the same muslin squares as the girls do. A little boy named Jimmy decided that the woman he most admired was Monica Seles. And some of you may remember this was a tennis star. A deranged fan came onto the court and it stabbed her. And so Jimmy, 11 years old, in his square, stitched a tennis racket with a bloody dagger. Now, it's hardly something. I mean, this must be original in the history of quilting. No girl would think of it. And I can understand why Ms. Logan was upset. She didn't want it on her quilt. But anybody that has sons or works with boys knows that there's a certain amount of, you know, explosions and pow, and there are daggers and, cops and robbers and so forth. And I think what Jimmy was doing was in the confines, the kind of oppressive confines of a feminist quilting environment. He was asserting his young maleness, which was under sustained attack by this teacher. Now, why is all of this happening? Why would we have Department of Education guides urging to play tag where no one is ever out? Or why would anyone come up with Sun's Day and think that is what boys need? Why are little boys quilting and sewing and so forth? What's going on? Some of it seems to me to be activities would be best for fragile mental patients, not healthy little boys or girls, for that matter. Well, in their defense, the Save the Males activists, the reformers, the girl advocates point out the high levels of violence in American society. Most of it is perpetrated by males. A lot of it is directed against women. And as they explain it, what they are attempting to do is to attack the problem at its root. What they're trying to do is to get to the boys at the earliest possible age to redirect them away from aggression and violence and towards nurture and compassion. And they come up with a lot of alarming statistics that really does make their cause seem wise and necessary, at least initially. I'll give you an example. I have several in the book, but I'll limit myself to one. The Department of Education supports something called the Gender Equity Resource Center. This is the Women's Educational Equity Act, the WEA Center. There's a government-subsidized website, the WEA website, and the woman who's the director of this program is named Catherine Hansen. And in some of her publications on this website, she lists some really shocking statistics about male violence. She says, for example, that violence in the United States is the leading cause of death for women, that every year 4 million women are beaten to death. And she goes on in this way, and 4 million women beaten to death every year, that's so extreme that you can understand why sensitive, compassionate people would want to have some radical interventions. And seen in this light, seen in the light of a kind of just holocaust of violence against women, you can understand the need for programs of the sort I've described. But there's a problem. The statistics on this government-subsidized website are wildly false. In fact, they're the most egregiously false statistics I have ever encountered. I wrote an entire book about feminist misinformation, and this is just to give you an example, 4 million women beaten to death every year in the whole country, of all ages combined, about 1 million women die. So she's saying, many times more are beaten to death than die. How many women are murdered in this country every year? Well, 1996, a typical year, about 3,600. Not 4 million. 3,600. Of those 3,600, how many were battered to death? The FBI doesn't track that, but it must be a very small number. But according to the WEA website, a government-subsidized website, 11,000 women are beaten to death every day. So I called Ms. Hansen. I mean, she's commissioned by Congress to do a report on gender equity. She has all sorts of ideas about how to save boys. She wants to go after Little League, and she says males... She describes males as being, intrinsically violent, and what we can do to overcome it, because she believes these wildly false statistics. So I asked her, where did you get that number? I thought maybe it was a misprint. And she said, I got it from the Justice Department. Well, of course she didn't. She's deeply confused. She's statistically challenged in such an extreme way, but she believes this propaganda. Now, this is just one example, but... what I found is that at the heart of the contemporary women's movement is a body of egregiously false information. And I say this as someone who considers herself a feminist. I became a feminist in the 70s because I didn't like male chauvinism. I didn't like the stereotypes about women, which were false. There was a lot of misinformation about women. And we organized a women's movement to combat it, and I hope have defeated a lot of the old-fashioned thinking about women. I know there's still room for improvement, but now it's as if the tables have turned, and there is this flood of, I would almost call it kind of hate propaganda against males. For the record, violence isn't the leading cause of injury to women or death for women. There are about 370,000. The leading cause is heart disease, followed by cancer, about 250,000 deaths a year. Female deaths from homicide, 3,600 approximately, far down after suicide, which is about 6,000. The movement to save the males in my opinion, is predicated on the fact of, or a kind of philosophy that the Weekly Standard writer David Brooks has called a philosophy of women are from Venus, men are from hell. And as I said, when I look at feminist statistics on violence, domestic violence, women's wages, women in education, I just found that most of the information, not all of it, but most that we're getting on these topics is inaccurate, sometimes wildly inaccurate, sometimes completely false. And over again, I find reference to this misinformation. Now, so I think the movement to re-educate American boys is based on a false picture of how dangerous and violent they are. Now, it's absolutely true. If you look at FBI data, 90% of violent crimes are committed by males. But the important thing to know is the vast majority of males are not violent and are not committing violent crimes. And again, a small percentage of boys are destined to become batterers and rapists, boys with severe conduct disorders. They're very high risk of becoming criminal predators, and such boys do need strong intervention. The earlier, the better. But this small number of boys should not be used to prop up an angry crusade that treats millions of normal and healthy male children as pathologically dangerous. And where did these phony statistics come from? There are various sources. Some of them are just hoaxes, just invented. One that I talked about in my last book, Who Stole Feminism, you may remember this canard that on Super Bowl Sunday, battery increases 40%. And women were warned. I think NBC ran a public service announcement sort of urging men to remain calm during the game. And it only took a little while for a wonderful reporter who checked the facts, Ken Ringel at the Washington Post, quickly determined that this was not true. There was no research that showed any such thing. It was I don't want to say a hoax because I don't even know if it was deliberate. I think somebody misunderstood something. It got repeated, and it ended up Robert Lipsight at the New York Times, a fine sports reporter, began to refer to the Super Bowl as the Abuse Bowl. And all of these phony statistics that I found always put men in a very bad light. It seems the purpose is to implicate the average male in a social atrocity. That's why I say I really think as feminists and concerned citizens, we have to look at this misinformation. If it were targeted at any other group, if people were putting out fact sheets, and these are all over there in the women's studies canon, they are on government fact sheets. If anybody was doing that about an ethnic group or about gay people or a religious group, we would recognize it as really mean-spirited, dangerous propaganda. And what I'm trying to tell you folks in this new book, The War Against Boys, I'm showing you that there are victims, that boys pay the price. There are teachers in our classroom who might have reviewed this literature. And we now see little boys, this is an extreme case, but I worry that it could become mainstream. A few weeks ago, some boys in New Jersey were playing cops and robbers in the playground, bang, bang, kindergartners. And I figured it was three or four of them were suspended. So there's just growing intolerance for natural, healthy male, just vitality. And by the way, where do these advocacy statistics come from? Some of them, as I said, are just hoaxes, misinformation. Another practice, I'm sorry to say, of some feminist researchers is what I call advocacy research. They will do a study determined to prove a point, and they will cheat a little bit on the definitions. And I'll give you an example of how that would work. Suppose I were a visiting sociologist that wanted to put the Commonwealth Club in a bad light. Well, let me ask a question, and I want everyone in the room to be perfectly honest about this. How many of you, when you were young, were ever kicked or hit or slapped or attacked in any way by a brother or sister? Okay, a lot of hands. I would almost say a majority. How many of you ever kicked or hit a brother or sister? Okay, I'm keeping notes here because I'm going to write as a visiting sociologist that there's an epidemic of family violence in members of the Commonwealth Club. Now, as I say, I'm not here to trivialize violence against women. As a philosophy professor and someone very committed to principles of compassion and fairness, I'm very, very concerned about these serious social problems. That's why we have to tell the truth about them. That's what's going to help women who are victims of violence, is compassion is on the side of truth, not hyperbole, not male bashing, not some out-of-control movement to put American men in a bad light. Now, suppose that we had really good information. And what I tried to do in The War Against Boys is in any domain, I asked myself, who's doing the most rigorous research? Who are the best social scientists, practitioners? Who are the experts? And typically it would be the government researchers. They have the biggest budgets, and they're really some of the best data-gathering agencies in the world. The National Center for Education Statistics. If you want to know how children are faring, go to the Department of Education, the National Center for Education Statistics. If you want to know the mental health in the society, go to the National Institutes of Health. Go to the National Center for Health Statistics. And what you find is that overall, most males and females in this society, including teenagers, are mentally sound, reasonable, more or less moral human beings. We need a little help there. I'll talk about that. Daniel Offer is a professor of psychiatry at Northwestern, and he recently summarized the findings of adolescent psychiatry in the Journal of the American Adolescent Psychiatry. He refers to, quote, a new generation of studies that find the majority of adolescents normal, well-adjusted. And yet all the time we heard about reviving Ophelia, that the nation's girls were drowning and disappearing and diminished. And now it's the boys, and I'm just afraid we are captive to this notion that, you know, the entire country, huge segments of the population are mentally disturbed, emotionally, racked with anxiety and so forth, and it's not true. At least the responsible scientists don't find it to be true. And again, if you look at the data on how men and women are faring in this society, what you find is a mix. You don't find, as some radical feminists say, that women are a subordinate class and they're held back. You find that American women are healthier than men, better educated, live longer. On the other hand, men have advantages. They're still overrepresented at the very extremes of success, CEOs of Fortune 500s. And so there's still room for improvement. But there's room for improvement for both men and women. But overall, you have to say that it's a society that's achieved a very high level of equality. It's the kind of feminism that I strongly believe in, equity feminism. An equity feminist wants for women what she wants for everyone, fair treatment, no discrimination. But I worry that the contemporary women's movement, the leadership, and groups like the American Association of University Women are so carried away with showing that girls are victims and boys are predators, that this misinformation is now very harmful to our young men. I don't think young women are helped by it either, but that's another book for another time. Now I want to change direction for a moment and say what I do think are some genuine problems with the nation's boys. I am not saying that boys don't need any improvement. They do. So do the girls. But as someone who has taught moral philosophy to college freshmen for nearly 20 years, I can tell you with some authority that we can be doing a much better job teaching the next generation about right and wrong, about basic ethics. And having immersed myself in the literature on sex differences, I will say this as well. All children need to be brought up with clear rules. They need structure. But I believe boys need these things even more than girls. Boys who are ethically neglected have some very unpleasant ways of getting themselves noticed. If you don't believe me, I mean, just look at, we see some footage from Central Park recently of young men just preying on women in the park. I'm not saying that girls are more moral than boys. They are not. Girls can be just as cruel and malicious. But cross-cultural studies confirm the obvious. Boys are physically more aggressive. There's a classic study, and it was done first in 1973, on male-female differences by Eleanor Maccabee and Carol Jacklin. It's, as I said, it's sort of the classic in the field. And they conclude that compared to boys, that boys engage in more mock fighting, more aggressive fantasies. They insult and hit one another more, and they retaliate more quickly when attacked. Quote, these sex differences are found as early as social play begins. A 1997 study at University of Vermont compared parents' reports of boys and girls, sons and daughters, and they looked at countries, very diverse assortment of countries from Thailand, Greece, Jamaica, the United States, Puerto Rico, and what they found is that in every case, boys are more likely than girls to fight, swear, throw tantrums, and threaten others. Well, Gloria Allred, the feminist lawyer, I debated about the Boy Scouts, and Gloria Steinem, who has said we need to raise our boys more like our girls, the experts at Harvard, Carol Gilligan, William Pollack, and the Department of Education that produces programs like Quit It. I think they look at these hitting, chasing, fighting, swearing, competitive creatures, and they see future criminals. I just see boys, many who are high-spirited, energetic, creative, and in need of developing a code of ethics. History teaches us that masculinity with morality is powerful, constructive. It also teaches us that masculinity without morality is terribly destructive. So every society confronts the problem of civilizing its young males. And it turns out that the traditional approach, well, there are at least two approaches to this. The traditional approach is to develop a young man's character through, as I said, moral education, develop his sense of honor, help him become a considerate, conscientious human being, turn him into a gentleman. This approach respects the boy's masculine nature. It's time-tested. It works. Even today, despite several decades of moral confusion, most young men still understand the term gentleman and the ideals it connotes. And I know some adults don't believe me. They think, oh, no, they don't. You know, they just think that's ridiculous. And go and talk to boys. Ask, and not little, not 10 or 11, but ask a 14 or 15-year-old boy. And I did. I interviewed boys from all walks of life, poor boys and wealthy boys, middle-class boys, boys in the Midwest, boys in urban Washington, D.C., and I have yet to find a boy for whom his eyes don't sort of light up. It's something he wants to be. But they don't really know how to do it. And it's, you know, as a society, we're not doing a very good job teaching them. But as I said, this is an approach to civilizing and humanizing a young man that's respectful of his male nature. What the Save the Male reformers are doing is proposing something quite different. Civilize boys by rescuing them from their masculinity, raising them more like girls. I find this approach unworkable and deeply disrespectful of boys. Now, I want to sort of end on an optimistic note. My book's subtitle is How Misguided Feminism is Harming Our Young Men. I say misguided because there is a more generous and accepting kind of feminism that I strongly believe in, as I've told you, a feminism that asserts equality between men and women but accepts differences between them, a feminism that calls for fairness and understanding between the sexes. And last year, a book came out entitled Between Mothers and Sons, and it's a collection of short stories by feminist writers on what it's like to have a son. And when I heard these feminist mothers were going to write about having sons, I thought, oh, dear, it's going to be depressing. It's going to be full of stories about boys behaving badly and how these mothers tried to save their sons from the clutches of the patriarchal, militaristic hegemony. And I expected to feel really sorry for the boys. But the book surprised me. These are stories about women rediscovering the nature of boys, accepting it, ultimately delighting in it. Now, some of the mothers in the book confess to having initially tried to raise their sons in conformity with feminist precepts. Deborah Galen is a short story writer and essayist, and she describes what happened when she sent her son Dylan to a Montessori school, which she says was, quote, run by a goddess-worshipping women's collective on Cape Cod. So there's Dylan off to school. It didn't work out. As she said, quote, something did not honor his boy soul. I think it was the absence of competition. Boys who clashed or tussled were separated and immediately counseled by peacemakers. Sticks were confiscated and turned into tomato steaks for the garden. Well, they were confiscating a lot of sticks from the boys. Galen posed a question that at first she found painful, but then she found a liberating answer. She said, she asked, how can I be a good feminist, a good pacifist, a good mother to a stick-wielding, weapon-generating boy? And what exactly is a five-year-old boy anyway? Well, here's her answer. A five-year-old boy, she said, I learned from reading summaries of various neurological studies, a five-year-old boy is a beautiful, fierce, testosterone-drenched, cerebrally asymmetrical humanoid, carefully engineered to move objects through space, or at least to watch others do so. Janet Burraway is a poet, novelist, self-described pacifist liberal. She has a son named Tim who grew up to be a career soldier. She doesn't know how this happened. How did he move in a direction so opposite her own? She recalls his abiding fascination with plastic planes, toy soldiers, military history, noting, quote, his direction was set early. She describes having taken him to a field of daffodils for him to celebrate the wonders of nature. And she says, quote, now looking at the toddler in the daffodils, I can see the clear contours of the hunter's face. Well, Tim takes her aback in many ways, but she's clearly proud of him. She came to see that he had a lot of her qualities, and she was very touched by what she called the chivalry in his character. She said he would literally lay down his life for a friend, and his capacity for loyalty, for courage, his commitment to excellence. All of this moved this mother, and she confesses, I'm forced to be aware of my own contradictions in the presence, in his presence, a feminist often charmed by his machismo. Well, Galen and Burroway discarded some of their anti-male prejudices when they discovered that boys have their own distinctive graces and virtues. The love and respect they shared with their sons helped them overcome some fashionable resentments that too many females harbor towards males. So my suggestion is that our society should learn from these feminist mothers. We need to rediscover the goodness of boys. We need to stop treating the Dylans and the Tims and Jimmy, the little boy who made the unusual quilting square. We have to stop treating Little Leaguers and Boy Scouts as if they were afflicted with some disorder called boyness. In conclusion, I'll say it is something very unfashionable, but I'm going to say it anyway. The energy, adventurousness, stoicism, competitiveness of normal, decent males is responsible for much of what is right with the world. All societies have understood this. All healthy societies appreciate and prize their young men. Why, in this day and age, should we be turning against them? I'm sure most of you will agree it just makes no sense. Now, if you're an optimist, as I am, you believe that good sense and fair play will prevail eventually. And if you're the mother of sons, as I am, you know that one of the more agreeable facts of life is that boys will be boys. Thank you.
Thank you, Christina Hoff Summers, author of The War Against Boys, and W.H. Brady Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, for your talk. Now, Patricia Sullivan, who chairs our section on psychology, will lead the question and answer segment.
Thank you, Tom Merle, our chair today. If you would join me back up here at the podium, please. We have quite a few questions. We'll get as many in as possible. First question, what teaching methods are most successful for boys? Why are the British more successful?
If you've been paying attention for the past 10 years, have read any number of alarming news stories in the mainstream press about how girls are shortchanged in the schools. This began around 1991 when the American Association of University Women released its first study. Then that was a follow-up study, How Schools Shortchange Girls. And over again, the theme was that girls are second-class citizens in our schools. And the idea was that boys are soaring, boys are thriving, and girls are languishing. Well, I'm sorry to report. I mean, it's good news for the girls, but as far as the boys are concerned, this simply was a gross oversimplification. The girls were a little bit behind in math and science. There were small deficits in math and science, but at the same time, there were huge deficits in reading and writing for the boys. The boys were also much more likely to be in the failing, flunking. The college gap now favoring girls is huge and growing. There are now about, our college population is 55% female, 45% male. There's no sign of a turnaround. In fact, the college board recently said somewhat facetiously, but with a serious undertone, that if current trends continue, the last male will graduate from American universities and colleges in 2067. So we've got to reverse these trends. Now, having said that, the AAUW, and again, they did some wonderful things for girls, but they did it at the expense of boys. And they get mad at me when I say this because they said, no, we didn't. We didn't want to polarize. You're polarizing. I'm not. I'm simply saying, number one, girls were never shortchanged. That a lot of that research was just outdated, or some of the misinformation, some of the advocacy research I mentioned, and all along these gaps have been there. The girls had moved ahead of boys in ways which are quite amazing. More since the late 80s, there have been more girls in honors programs like the advanced placement. It's more girls than boys. More girls in student government. More girls in writing for school newspapers, even debating societies. It's a small difference, but more girls than boys. So American girls, there's a lot of good news. They are not drowning Ophelias. They are not, as Carol Gilligan described them, silenced and diminished. They're arguably some of the most outspoken, successful, just vibrant young women in human history, and I think we do them a disservice to paint them in these bleak terms. Now, the British, at the same time that our girls started to move ahead of the boys, it was going on in Britain. It happened in the late 80s, early 90s. And the British, they don't seem to have these girl partisan organizations. They have education researchers that wanted to do what they could to help kids, and they noticed the boys were falling behind. So they have, they're about 10 years ahead of us in addressing the reading gap, the writing gap. And the average American boy, according to the Department of Education, the 11th grade boy writes like an 8th grade girl. And if any of you have sons, this won't come as a complete surprise. The average girl is much more committed to school. That's the critical variable we should have been looking at, the child's commitment to school. That's a huge predictor to academic success. The girls care a lot more. The British are looking for ways to re-engage boys, and they're bringing back old-fashioned pedagogy, old-fashioned teaching methods that have been out of style in our schools for years. They're out of style in Britain, but they're finding they work for boys. The boys like classroom competition, not rugged individualism. They break them into teams, and a boy will do anything for his team. And so they, you know, you have teams, and who's going to do the best at the geography quiz, and who's going to do the best on the math? They've brought back competition. Memorization, little boys, it turns out, like that, will do it. Facts, the fact-loving male mind, as Camille Paglia refers to it. And little boys, they're bringing back war poetry, adventure stories, and all-male classes. For low-achieving boys, they're experimenting with all-male classes. We can't do that right now. If you try that, even with the most low-achieving boys, if you try something special for these boys, you will be threatened with a lawsuit from, for example, the National Organization for Women. So this is what we're confronting. So the British are ahead of us. The good news is they're making headway, and we need to follow their example. And that means the girl partisan groups should step back for a while and not try to shape this discussion.
What is your assessment of the significance of the Columbine shootings? Do girls ever go on such killing rampages?
Very rarely. You will occasionally have a Susan Smith, you drown her children, and, you know, a Tanya Harding. So there are girls. But far more, it's going to be males. I mean, this is cross-cultural, universal. Males can be more violent. More sociopathic violence comes from males. But again, let's think about Columbine and put it in perspective. These boys, the two killers, were arguably, even among sociopaths, they were at the extreme. These are two of the most disturbed children, in psychiatric history, or close. And think of all the boys at Columbine that day. There were hundreds of boys. Some behaved heroically. Later, if you recall, those very touching memorial services. There were boys who'd written songs. There were boys who'd written poetry. There are so many wonderful boys in the country. And yet, if I'm right, if we are in the middle of a period of just terrible bigotry towards males, it's not surprising that the worst case males then become emblems for all males. And this is what I see. Suddenly, when boys behave badly, they become the symbol for American boys. But what about all the boys, I mean, my sons and your sons and all the wonderful boys we know? And what I think is happening is that people have convinced themselves that masculinity is the fault, and so anything masculine creatures do is suddenly used to smear everyone of that sex. And so that's what I thought about the Columbine. Having said that, there is a chapter in my book, The War Against Boys, about the moral life of boys and the importance of having some kind of moral community in the school. And what I've learned about the school at Columbine is there was a terrible amount of bullying going on. There was a kind of moral drift, which was appalling. These boys were allowed to come to school with swastikas on their T-shirts. That's free speech. They were allowed to write just gruesomely violent stories. And when a teacher tried to get help, no one intervened. There were all sorts of signs. And then at another level, the kids didn't treat each other well in that school. And people say, well, that's just kids. They'll be cruel. No, teachers can make a difference, and parents can make a difference. So as a moral philosopher, I strongly believe in having clear rules of civility, even rules of kindness. Try to teach kids in every way you can as an adult and a teacher to, live by some principles of compassion. And, of course, it's not always easy, but I've seen many schools where they don't try at all, and there's a big difference between schools that make an effort and schools that don't. And I think all of these things happened in Columbine. You had sociopaths. You had a bad moral environment. But finally, let's not attack all boys for the misdeeds of a tiny percentage.
What do you think of the public comments of Hillary Clinton and Tipper Gore on this subject?
Well, I guess I don't really, I'm not sure what subject, so I'll just respond to their general attitudes. I guess what worries me a little bit in some of Tipper Gore's remarks is this idea that that there's high levels of mental illness in the society. If you go to, as I said, to the National Institutes of Health and you talk to the epidemiologists, you find the following. About 20% of Americans, let's say adolescents, about 20% have some kind of problem. That's a lot. But, of course, that means 80% do not. Let's not forget the healthy 80%. Now, of those 20%, 3 to 6% are in serious trouble. And they need help, and we're not providing it. And I completely agree with Mrs. Gore that far more should be done in identifying these kids with mental health problems. If it's 3 to 6%, that means probably all of us in here know somebody who needs help. And so what I'm saying is, yes, let's have programs to help the children who are genuinely at risk, but never forget that the vast majority of kids are healthy, they're resilient, they're mentally sound, they are academically undernourished, they are ethically underdirected, I can say, but we must credit them with mental health. And I'm afraid there's a tendency in the society not only to malign boys, which is out of control, but I think maligning teenagers. And over again, people who haven't had any acquaintance with teenagers will meet a group of them or something. A group of boys will come for some purpose, and they'll say, oh, they were so nice. I was so surprised. But they are nice. The vast majority are humane and considerate human beings. I'm just worried that Mrs. Gore's, if she overstates it. So I think that's the important thing, is not to pretend that the vast segments of the population are suffering. They're not. And we have to remember that most of us are sound.
How large does a minority of problem teenagers have to be before you start to worry? Does the fact that a majority of kids are doing fine tell us much less than you might suggest?
Well, first of all, I think we just have to go by common sense and how to treat our children. And I know, for example, everyone's very worried about school violence, and I'm worried about it, except that when you go to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, you find that it's actually down by a lot, and that it's statistically one of the safest places to be for a child is at school. And yet we overreact, and we've got schools now that have all sorts of, they're hiring armed guards and metal detectors and sort of treating the children as if they are proto-criminals. And I just think that's the wrong way to go. So I think that we have to be reasonable. And as I said, there's a common sense deficit when it comes to what to do with children. And, of course, I want to agree with those who are concerned about teenagers, because I do think a small percentage are at severe risk. And we're not doing a good job. But I think that's where our efforts should go into schools should have psychologists who are good at screening and focus on the children that have signs. There are clear signs. Boys, for example, that are going to be in serious trouble, they show signs as early as 3 or 4 years old. A child that's cruel to an animal or that starts fires or is, these are signs of severe danger. And that's, just to give an example. But what worries me is that we're taking normal behavior and projecting all sorts of pathologies. And just quickly to give an example, There's a wonderful researcher, Anthony Pellegrini, at the University of Minnesota, who studies the way children play. And he has said, and almost everyone who studies children will agree, that the characteristic play of little boys is rough-and-tumble play, which is mock fighting and running and carrying on and rowdiness. Mothers and teachers typically don't like it and put it outside, but sometimes fathers will go along with it. But anyway, there's one expert has said there's sort of the culture of women and the culture of boys. And traditionally, women have understood and made, you know, allowed for it. And some of the experts, like Anthony Pellegrino, are worried that we're not making a clear distinction between aggression and rough and tumble play and violence. If children, watch a group of boys involved in wild play, and they're usually laughing, they part as friends, a great deal of fun. I mean, there's just no more sort of rollicking fun than little boys wrestling and carrying on. When boys are fighting, when it's violence, they're not laughing. You just look at their faces. You can see they're suffering. Someone usually will often get injured, and they part as enemies. The healthy, rambunctious play of little boys, it's universal, it's a good thing, it's more than that, it's critical to their healthy development. So I worry that we're taking, you know, a few extreme cases and using it to come down and move in on the healthy play of little boys and turn that into as if it's some kind of disorder. So I'm strongly arguing in the book we must preserve the distinction between rough and tumble play and violence. And if we fail to do that, we'll cause serious harm to our boys.
Are you suggesting that the issue of sexism in the, quote, normal, average, unquote, males has become obsolete?
Sexism will never be entirely obsolete. There will always be Neanderthals among us. However, I now think it goes both ways. I think there are women sexists. And we have the word misogynist. I don't think we even need to invent it. I think we have the word misandrist. Is a woman who dislikes men and willing to believe the worst. And what I think is that our women's movements should sort of change with the times and adapt. And many of the battles have been won. We now have a society where, as I said, women are 55% of college enrollments. If you look at as the Department of Education did, they do measures of children's aspirations. The girls are more ambitious than the boys. The girls are just in so many ways moving ahead of the boys that to talk about sexism in the schools, I honestly believe that we have to look at the other kind of sexism against boys. So without overstating it and saying all the problems are over, no, as an equity feminist, I don't believe they're over. In my philosophy classes, I always made a point of telling my students about how recent women achieved emancipation and that women's freedoms were, you know, if not defended and understood, could be fragile and something to be always to fight for. But I, as I said, I didn't become a feminist to become a chauvinist against men, a misandrist. So that's what I see. For every sexist, there's probably a misandrist. And what I'm arguing is maybe we need a sort of third stage. We've had our third wave. We had the first wave of feminism, which was the great movement for the suffrage and basic rights with Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony. Then we had the second wave in the 70s that opened up the workplace, educational environment, educational opportunities for women. But I think the third wave should be men and women coming together and mutual respect. And equal concern for our sons and daughters. But we're not there yet. Thank you.
Do boys play too many video games?
Oh, probably. What mother wouldn't say that? They do. Girls play them too. They don't buy the same games. The best-selling video game, or among the best-selling of all times, was Talk to Me, Barbie, and of course it was the girls that were buying it, and they play it avidly. And the boys like the sports games and the games, that appeal to their, you know, vivid, wild imaginations. And it's true, boys have violent fantasies. And now, as a society, we're very nervous that they're, you know, in any little boys' games, you hear a lot of pow and bang and bam and so forth. Mothers are getting nervous. But go back to the fairy tales that fascinated children. There's always been a dark side and a violent side, and in Goldilocks and the Three Bears, and Little Red Riding Hood, and so forth. I mean, to suddenly, I don't know, want to treat what I think is quite innocent play of children, and to turn it into something bizarre and dangerous, is very sad. It's very sad indeed, and I'm hoping that in doing this book and others will come forward and beginning to defend the interests of boys. There are schools now that are getting rid of recess. This is now a trend. Now, speaking as having once been a girl in school, I can tell you I loved recess. It was important. But I know, having looked at the research on sex differences, it is critical to boys. A little boy can sit still for only, not very long at all, but I mean, certainly very young grades, much less time than a girl. His ability to concentrate and focus, he needs the play. And yet, there's no one out there. If they were doing something that was so contrary to girls' interests, fortunately, there are groups that would step forward and say, no, wait a minute, this is really going to have a terrible impact on girls. There are no groups that step forward for boys. So when they eliminate recess, as they've done in the Atlanta schools, in schools in Philadelphia, they have what's called monitored recess, where the children are carefully monitored and structured play. And so the video games, of course, the more extreme ones, I don't understand. And we get into issues about, what kind of decisions are parents making, allowing their kids to play these games. But overall, even with these games, I have to say the children overall are not violent. So we'd need much more careful studies to show the cause and effect. Common sense tells me they are encouraging violence, but this seems to be true of only a limited number of children. And I worry that some of it is just people don't like the way boys play.
And now for our final question, who are your role models?
Well, my role models, certainly my mother, who taught me at a very young age to love to read and love ideas and to be curious about the world. That was critical to me. And like everyone else, I have a few teachers that I look back in junior high and high school. That may be a reason why I sort of doubted when I heard about how girls are so diminished in the classroom. It just did not resonate with what I remember, because the girls, I think up until about 11th or 12th grade, we just assumed the girls were smarter than the boys because we were teacher's pet and getting better grades. And in California, they had programs called Accelerated English and Accelerated Spanish and so forth, and there were hardly any boys. The boys caught up in 12th grade in Accelerated Physics and Math. They showed up in droves. But I had teachers in almost all girl classes in California public schools. Who inspired me. And finally, my philosophy professors. I went to college in the height of the sort of flower child movement, and I was a flower child, and I think I would have studied, witchcraft or something if it was available, but it wasn't. The major that I thought was the most sort of strange and interesting was philosophy, but it wasn't strange and mysterious. The teachers that I had, there were several visiting professors from Oxford University who believed in clear thinking. They believed in analytic reasoning. I remember I had a very extreme professor from Oxford who thought Americans were irrational, and he said, you should all be locked in a room for 3 weeks with a rational person and have all your ideas examined, I said, okay. But anyway, I was fascinated with this love of clarity. It seemed, as a California flower child, I thought it was far out. And but I just got hooked on the scientific method. And also very curious about the world. And I worry with our children, if we're treating them sort of therapeutically, look inward, be in touch with your inner nurturer. They don't need that. Our kids are already more self-absorbed and narcissistic than children anywhere. What American kids need, as far as I can tell, is to be interested in the world, challenged, things outside themselves. And this self-esteem movement, I mean, would I have liked it? I might have as a dreamy little kid, But fortunately, the teachers didn't think of doing that. They tried to make you curious and aware. And I'm sure many of you had the benefit of an education like that. So that's what I'm trying to restore to our schools. And I know those teachers are still there that can do it, but they're not given support. So what I tried in the book to do was to give support to teachers who who like to teach in the old-fashioned way that I think appealed to boys and girls, and certainly as a girl growing up, it appealed to me. Thank you.
Our thanks to Christina Hoff Summers, author of The War Against Boys, How Misguided Feminism is Harming Our Young Men, for speaking to us today. We also thank our audience here in San Francisco, as well as those listening on the radio, and invite all of you to join us again soon. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the nation's oldest and largest public affairs forum, is adjourned.